This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
You're hearing the sounds of the National Aquarium in Baltimore, one of my favorite places that we visited in the course of recording our season there. This is Working, the podcast about what people do all day. I'm Jacob Brogan. This season on the show, we're taking a trip to Baltimore to chat with some of its residents about the various ways they make a living there. We're hoping to learn a little about the ways that Baltimore shapes their work and about the ways they're shaping Baltimore by working.
Can you see him? Put your head against the glass and look right there.
When we first announced we were heading to Maryland for this series, many of our listeners wrote in to suggest that we visit the National Aquarium, one of Baltimore's greatest highlights, and we were happy to oblige. It's a massive facility with thousands of organisms on display, from sea turtles to sharks to dolphins. Unsurprisingly, keeping all those undersea animals healthy is a massive undertaking. To better understand how they pull it off, we spoke to Lee Clayton, the aquarium's director of animal health. Clayton explains how you tell when a fish is sick and leads us through the process of diagnosis and treatment. She also shares a particularly memorable surgery story and offers some practical tips for those who are looking to keep the fish in their home aquariums healthy. And of course, she speaks to the National Aquarium's relationship with Baltimore more generally and its connection to the Chesapeake Bay. Then, in a Slate Plus Extra, Clayton tells us about working with my favorite animal, the octopus. If you're a member, enjoy bonus segments and interview transcripts from Working, plus other great podcast exclusives. Start your 2-week free trial at slate.com/workingplus. What is your name and what do you do?
My name's Lee Clayton and I'm the Director of Animal Health and Welfare here at National Aquarium.
Can you tell us a little bit about what that entails? How many charges do you have? How many animals are you looking after?
Right, yeah, the veterinary department here helps care for all of our animals, and including our invertebrates, that's about 15,000.
It's a lot of animals.
Of about 800 different species.
I assume that the training you did can't have prepared you to work with every single one of those animals. I mean, was a lot of the learning on the job?
Yeah, yes. And this is really true for many veterinarians, though. You are able to take facts you know and approaches you know from one species and then apply it to similar species. So it's a really interesting combination of being able to get into the details, but then also stay more broad and kind of take what you know in a general approach and apply it in new and unique ways. Because one of the cool things about being an animal here on Earth is that there's a lot of continuity and similarities between species.
Mm-hmm. Were there any really prominent differences that stood out when you started focusing more on marine wildlife?
Yeah, I do remember like when I was a vet student being like, oh my God, you can do surgery on a fish? and so I can relate when we have visitors come through, you can take a fish out of water, you know, and it's like, you know, you have to kind of reset. Because of course to us, it's like, well, yeah. And so you just have to remind yourself that it is kind of weird, you know, that yes, we can take a fish out of water and we're careful to keep the gills moist. And that's actually how we anesthetize them and we keep their skin moist. But you can take a fish out of water and do surgery on it and return it and they can do great. And actually, one of my favorite little cases is we had an intern who was able to go in and take a cyst, a really large cyst off the liver of a fish that was part of a group that's in the Black Tip Reef exhibit. Mm-hmm. And it's there now, and it's getting bigger, and it's still part of
the fish,
school.
Not the cyst.
Yeah, exactly.
The cyst is gone.
And so every time I go look at that exhibit, I think of, you know, our trainee and her ability to do this and our ability to help her do it. And I do think it's something that over time would have been problematic for this animal, mm-hmm. and we were able to, you know, kind of fix it. And so, there's the animal.
This is probably a dumb question, but how do you know when a fish is sick?
Yeah, right. Great question. Same way we know when other animals are sick. We often are looking for changes in their behavior and mm-hmm. changes in how they look. So when a fish isn't feeling well, it often will change color a little bit. It may be mm-hmm. darker or lighter than usual. Then if it's a schooling fish, rather than keeping up with the rest of the school, it's often lagging behind mm-hmm. in a very consistent way. It may not be holding its fins in the right location, mm-hmm. the right orientation. They'll often clamp their fins in tight against their body. Mm-hmm. And they can look as if they're in pain. And that's real hard to appreciate in a fish, but they'll often just kind of sit there and they're not really paying as much attention to the external environment. Mm-hmm. They're not looking around as much. They're not tracking movements as much. They're sort of turned inward. So it actually looks very similar to if you or I were sick or if our dogs weren't feeling well. You know, they're just not up and active as much.
Do those observations come to you from other, would the right word here be keepers at the facility? Or is it you and your team who are making the rounds, keeping an eye on animals?
We do both, but it's really for the staff that take care of the animals daily. That's part of what they are really experts in, mm-hmm. is knowing how the animals under their care go about their typical day. Mm-hmm. And if there's a variation from that, then they evaluate that variation and will be thinking, is this normal? So for instance, is the turtle basking more because she's getting ready to lay eggs? Mm-hmm. Or is the turtle basking more because she's not feeling well? Mm-hmm. And so that's their area of expertise. And quite often we'll come together and talk about it as a group. And if we're not sure, because for some animals you're like, well, you know, she lays eggs at this time every year, and we're going to be like, well, she's probably laying eggs. If it's a different time of year, then we would, for that same animal, probably do something like bring her over to our hospital area, do some blood work, do a complete physical exam, get x-rays, do an ultrasound much sooner.
So how do you work from those initial observations then to an actual diagnosis and a treatment plan?
For a lot of us who work in zoos and aquariums, and even vets working with pets, your exam really starts the minute you see the animal. Mm-hmm. You know, you're evaluating and sort of looking at that picture compared to a mental image of what the animal should be looking like. Mm-hmm. Then we'll often do a hands-on exam, and then we'll often do diagnostics.
Kind of palpitated skills or something?
Yes, you palpate, exactly. You get a heart rate, you listen to the heart, you listen for the gut sounds, depending on what species you're working with. Mm-hmm. You know, our set panel of diagnostics is really blood work, x-ray, ultrasound. Mm-hmm.
How do you x-ray a fish, though?
Yep, we x-ray them the same way we do any animal. There's an x-ray plate, and there's an x-ray unit that sends the x-rays. We're all digital now, so the plate is electronic, and then process that image, and it comes up on a computer. But you can take the fish out of water. For most fish, we actually have to sedate them a little bit, mm-hmm. And that makes them more calm.
And you say you do that through the gills?
Yeah, so we put their anesthetic into the water that they're in, and it crosses the gills into the bloodstream and into the brain, and they'll, you know, sort of go to sleep. We lift them out of the water and take our x-rays and put them back in.
Presumably you've put them into a separate tank or something
mm-hmm.
first
yeah.
so that it's not putting other fish to sleep.
Exactly. We, if we have a concern about a fish, we have transport containers, and the aquarist takes water from the main area typically. Mm. With fish, it's very, very important that your water is consistent. Changes in the pH of the water, the temperature, those sorts of things can really upset the fish's physiology and hurt them. Mm. So we're very careful to match the water and make sure it's the same water when we work with them. But yeah, and most fish handle that amazingly well. You know, I think you might think like, oh, it would be so stressful. And the majority of our animals, if they're feeling okay, it's pretty common that like the aquarist is calling us that afternoon. Well, he ate this afternoon. Yeah. And so I think for many animals, they roll with it just as we do. Mm-hmm. You know, like we don't go to the doctor, most of us, and then we're like, oh my God, that was so traumatic. I can't eat for 4 days. And for our animals, it's very, very similar. It's just something that happens and they're like, okay, well that happened and here's my food.
Are there any animals that are especially difficult to work with?
You know, humans are always, right? That's always the answer. Humans tend to be the most complex to work out the social relationships and the negotiations and all of that.
But here in the facility?
Not our humans, you know, our people.
Sure. Your people are great.
For our animals, I think our most challenging ones are the animals that are in our largest habitats. Some of them we train to sort of come to us and participate in going into a stretcher or some other device so we can get them out. Others, you know, that can be our limiting factor, is we just can't get our hands on them readily.
Mm-hmm. Any specific ones that tend to be more difficult?
Schooling fish, fast swimming schooling fish are probably the hardest to work with as individuals.
Because their whole evolutionary process is about evading capture.
Yeah, exactly. Yep, absolutely.
How do you relate to an animal as you're going through this diagnostic process? Do you anthropomorphize it at all, or is it, are you really just thinking in kind of raw bioscientific terms about it?
You know, honestly, I think we do both. We certainly talk about the animal's emotional states, and that is really important to us as we move through how we're going to handle animals. We're working with animals over years. We're working with animals often as they age and go through sort of into their geriatric years. And so it's very similar to working with a pet, where you start to, you know, what's in the best interest of this animal? Does it have an issue that I can make better? Or does it have a problem that's a chronic disease? And so we're looking at maybe doing less with it, but we want to go into a discussion of its quality of life. How is this animal experiencing its day to day? And so we do have to make assumptions, but we do those based on monitoring behavior very carefully and being very familiar with what normal looks like for those animals.
When you're talking about the emotional state of an animal in your care, is there ever any risk that that kind of anthropomorphic, possibly necessary, but still anthropomorphic relationship to an animal makes it harder to see the specificity of its own experience, of its own
animality? I think it's possible, and I think one of the things that we work, I think it's possible whenever you are a person interacting with anything, you know, your child, a spouse, your dog, your cat, an animal here, trying to keep in mind, am I doing this for the animal or am I doing this for myself? Am I doing this really for my child, or I'm doing this because it's easiest for me and it's what I want to do? You know, being aware of what you bring to the table, you can never fully escape from yourself. You know, you are who you are, and you're bringing your experiences and expectations and fears and all the rest of it to the table with all of your interactions. So absolutely, is there risk of that for a veterinarian or a husbandry staff member here interacting with our animals? Sure there is, because there is that's, you know, the side effect of being a person. And so we have systems in place to try to make sure that we're balancing that.
Do you get emotionally invested in the animals?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. It's very hard to kind of, for me at least, it's hard for me to feel as if I'm bringing my best without having a little bit of that. And so that's also, you know, sometimes there's cases where I maybe will step back. Rarely now, maybe more when I was younger, because you do always need to be aware. And you want to be in a system where somebody can kind of tap you on the shoulder and, you know, be like, hey, wait. The reality is it's not ever too much of a problem. I think as vets, you get very good at compartmentalizing. Mm-hmm. You're doing a professional role and you act through that role. Where it comes in would be more with vet wellness, I guess, you know, making sure that if it was a challenging emotional situation, you're giving yourself the space to process that in a different location. Because if you don't do that, if you're not monitoring your own wellness, that can catch up with you. You know, that's where you end up in trouble.
I imagine that sometimes you must just lose an animal. I mean, sometimes you probably can't save them. What's that like?
It varies. So actually today, we examined an elderly knobtail gecko, and she has had a slower decline, and the keepers brought it to our attention. And in evaluating her, she appears to have either cancer or some other internal problem. She's very, very anemic, has almost no red blood cells. Mm-hmm. And so today we're in the process of making that very, you know, decision that for this animal in this context, we're going to go ahead and euthanize. You can see I'm getting all, we're going to go ahead and euthanize her. And so as a vet, there's a piece of you that's like, I just want to try the surgery. But she has no red cells. You know, we don't really have a good blood transfusion option. She's quite old. Mm-hmm. And in this case, it's not in her best interest. Yeah. She's lived almost 10 years here, I think, which is pretty long, very long for that particular species. And, you know, just as you would with a pet, you sometimes make these decisions. It's not right. And so we'll go ahead and we're working with the curator right now. So that's our day. We jump in and out of this all the time.
You're listening to Lee Clayton, the National Aquarium's Director of Animal Health. In a moment, Clayton tells us about a memorable veterinary surgery.
What's the best way to learn a language? Immersion. Living where the language is spoken and using it every day in everyday situations. But if that's not on the cards this year, you can still learn a language the second best way, and that's with Babbel. I've used apps in the past to learn new languages, but when I came across Babbel, I wondered if it could help me refresh my knowledge of a language I once spoke well, but was now a little bit or quite a lot rusty. I have to say, I was impressed. The advanced lessons were really useful, tips and idioms that can help with in-depth conversations on topics that I can actually imagine chatting about. Babbel's quick 10-minute lessons are handcrafted by over 200 language experts to help you start speaking a new language in as little as 3 weeks. Babbel is designed by real people for real conversations, and the tips and tools are approachable, accessible, rooted in real-life situations, and delivered with conversation-based teaching so you're ready to practice what you've learned in the real world. What's more, all of Babbel's 14 award-winning language courses are backed by their 20-day money-back guarantee. Here's a special limited-time deal for working listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, but only for working listeners, at babbel.com/working. Get up to 60% off at babbel.com/working, spelled BABBEL.com/working. Rules and restrictions may apply.
Can you describe your working area? Like, what is the actual veterinary facility, surgery area, whatever it is, look like?
Yeah, so we actually do work throughout the building, uh-huh. which is one of the cool things about it. But
so you don't just have a dedicated medical bay.
We don't, yeah. So, and we'll do a lot of things right where the animals are. Mm-hmm. But we do have what we call our surgery, and it's really our hospital treatment room. Mm-hmm. And it's a large room where we have all of our diagnostic equipment.
X-ray, blood testing.
Some of the blood testing. We've got an ultrasound machine there. Mm-hmm. Everything's on wheels so that we can move it around. Everything is small. The advantages of modern technology, you can get amazing computing power and teeny tiny devices. And that's because we often want to take it out and work with the animals. And it's one big room, and the equipment is all around the edges. And you would walk in and recognize things like needles and syringes and gloves and alcohol and all of the stuff you would normally see at a clinic.
I assume, though, you also have lots more water accessible
to
keep things moistened?
We do, but we don't have it in our surgery area, okay. per se. The water comes with the animals. And if the animals are of a sufficient size, we go to the animal. Mm-hmm. You know, we do a lot of home visits. It tends to work better for everybody.
Yeah. You are wearing what look like scrubs.
Yes.
Is that your uniform?
It's my uniform.
Or were you just actually in surgery?
I was not actually doing surgery. No, but this is my uniform. But we do perform surgeries here.
Have there been any particularly memorable surgeries that you could tell us about?
Yes. Let's see. One of the more memorable ones, in a different gecko species, we had one that had a very large mass. and this was many years ago now.
You're pointing to your neck.
I know,
is
my
that,
neck.
Was
it had was a it neck on mass. Its neck? Yes, okay. It had a ventral neck mass, a mass on the bottom part of its neck. And we ultrasounded it and aspirated it and couldn't quite figure out what it was and talked with the curator and the husbandry, you know, and we're like, let's just go in and try. We don't know what it is, and it's obviously not normal, so let's just go in and try. So we went in, and it was this big cystic structure, and we're like, it looks like it's where the thyroid would be. We've never heard about thyroid issues like this in a lizard, and we just sort of, oh, look, one of them popped out, and we removed that, and then there was this other mass, and it popped out, and so it had this bilobed thyroid with these huge cystic weird structures, and easy to get out, and we closed it back up and sent them off for histology, and the gecko recovered and did really well, but now it didn't have any thyroid. So we started it on thyroid supplementation, just as you would with a human.
I am also on thyroid supplementation.
Yeah.
I don't.
There you go.
I had my thyroid removed a few years ago,
so
I
so
relate,
you can relate
to this gecko
to the
very
gecko.
Much. Yeah.
And we were like, well, we don't know what'll happen, but let's just try. And we're using, you know, a medication that's made for humans.
Levothyroxine or something.
Yes, exactly. We have to crush it up. You're on it, and we're giving it to this gecko, and. Lo and behold, it does great. And we monitor its thyroid levels, not from blood levels, because A, we don't have normals, and B, they're really hard to bleed. And so we just do it based on its heart rate and its shedding rate, because uh-huh. those are two things that the thyroid helps to control. And experimenting for a while, we figured out what looked like kept it most similar to the other geckos, and that's its dose. And she's still with us. And it's been... I don't know, 6-7 years, something like that. It's been a while.
I love it. How do you figure out what the right, how do you like titrate the right dose of a thyroid medicine for,
right.
because like I take a massive amount for some reason, 300 micrograms of this thing, but a gecko weighs a lot less than me. What is it? How much levothyroxine do you give to a?
So I don't, basically a couple of little drops. So yeah. This is a perfect example of how you're integrating all of this information. So I don't have anything that can tell me what the dose is for a gecko.
Uh-huh.
I don't have anything that really can tell me what the dose is for a lizard or even a reptile. And so we usually start with a dose that works in dogs and cats. We typically go to dogs and cats first or something like that. Mm-hmm. So we look up the dose for cats. Or dogs. And we go, okay, well, that we'll start there. So we get in the tablets. The tablets we obviously can't give to the gecko because that would be a huge overdose. So we crush the tablets up. We mix it into a suspension. And now the suspension has a set amount of mgs per mil. And we take the gecko's weight and we take our desired dosage. And then we, you know, divide it by the concentration. And we have the amount we're going to give the gecko. And so we give it to the keepers and we say, please give this to your gecko every day. And it's something ridiculous. I mean, it's less than a drop. If you're used to a drop from like a dropper for eye meds, it's less than that by quite a bit. And we start there and we monitor how our gecko does and is the gecko up and active and eating? Does it seem overly hungry? Then maybe our dose is too high. Does it seem not hungry enough? Maybe our dose is too low. Is the heart rate where it should be or is the heart rate too low? Is it shedding frequency appropriate for that species? And we just sort of went off of our knowledge of animals in general and then fine-tuned it for this animal in particular. And we have to be careful because if she gets too heavy, we have to adjust the dose a little bit.
Because that would be an indication that it was too low.
It could be too low or they just a new keeper came on and decided to feed her twice as often maybe. And then so the keepers are great. They get weekly weights on her and our veterinary interns, she's on I think her fourth veterinary intern. So they get her case and they go up once a month and they do a little physical and they get her heart rate and we double check our doses fine and we move on.
How late are you here at night?
It varies. So some days we leave at 5 or 6 and other days we're here until 10 or 12.
Are you ever like on call late at night? Are there times when it's like, I gotta get back to the aquarium for a
yes,
shark emergency?
Yeah, exactly. Sometimes, but that's really, really infrequent. Uh-huh. Honestly, things work. I need to knock on wood. Usually things go fine.
Uh-huh.
Occasionally we'll have, you know, a rare case that we may be staying late for to monitor almost overnight, but that's pretty infrequent for us. We're lucky that way.
What happens when there is some kind of emergency in the middle of the day or, mm-hmm. or whenever it is?
What's the
kind of information flow there?
Yeah, so things obviously come up at all times. And we rely on the radio as a primary way of communicating with people. And
do you keep one on you?
Mm-hmm, yeah. Yes.
There it is.
So we talk to each other on the radio is our primary way of reaching out instantly to try to notify somebody that something has changed. And then if it has, we find a phone to have a more detailed conversation. Mm-hmm. So we're not, you know, on the radio talking about, you know, taking up 5 minutes of radio time.
Sure.
And very often we'll, you know, maybe grab some stuff and go up to where the emergency may be happening. At other situations, we'll determine it's just easiest for the husbandry staff to bring the animals over to the surgery area and work with them there. Most of the time, it's things that can be resolved just with a conversation, or they're alerting us that something has changed, and we'll go do maybe a physical exam and decide, oh, this one's okay. We'll just get it on the schedule for, you know, we'll get an appointment for it, basically. Mm-hmm. And so we kind of mimic what you might see in a 24-hour clinic. We've got pieces of it that we'll do emergency care, and it's like drop everything and go deal with that. But more often it's, you know, okay, well, this has happened and now we need to get it an appointment. Mm-hmm. Our appointments are usually in the morning between 9:30 and 11. And so we try to keep animal procedures in the morning and leave the afternoon free for kind of rechecks and paperwork. It almost never works out that way, but that's the goal, is do all this stuff in the morning and then write up about it and read about it in the afternoon.
Is that stuff ever frustrating, having to do the real practical parts of the job?
No. I mean, I look at it. I have a great team, so I have delegated parts of it. But I look at it as, you know, that's the cost of doing business, right? Yeah. You know, I'm part of a company. It's not just up to me. I've got accountants who need what they need to do their job well to support the organization. And so I try to look at it kind of holistically. Mm-hmm. You know, when I say I need something, I like it when other people trust that I need that. And they just trust me enough to be like, okay, Dr. Clayton needs that. Here you go. And so I try to give my colleagues in the organization to say, all right, Megan in finance says she needs this. I'll do it because I don't understand finance.
You're listening to the National Aquarium's Lee Clayton. After this brief break, she talks about the educational component of her work.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Most of you listening right now are probably multitasking. Yep, while you're listening, you're probably also driving, cleaning, exercising, or maybe even grocery shopping. But if you're not some kind of moving vehicle, there's something else you can be doing right now, getting an auto quote from Progressive Insurance. It's easy, and you could save money by doing it right from your phone. Drivers who save by switching to Progressive save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Discounts for having multiple vehicles on your policy, being a homeowner, and more. So, just like your favorite podcast, Progressive will be with you 24/7, 365 days a year, so you're protected no matter what. Multitask right now. Quote your car insurance at progressive.com to join over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Baltimore has this major harbor and bay. Mm-hmm. It's, with water is essential to the city's identity, as I understand it. Does that connection shape the work that you all do here?
I think it does. I think being part of the Chesapeake Bay is one of the neatest things about the aquarium here. Mm-hmm. And we've gotten more and more ability to sort of move into projects in this area. Because even within our own backyard, there's an immense amount we don't know. So for instance, one of the projects we are looking to begin this summer with our rescue group is to get a better understanding of how sea turtles use the upper Chesapeake Bay.
Oh, wow.
We understand more about how they use the lower Chesapeake, kind of down by Virginia where it connects with the Atlantic. We know they come up, not necessarily into the Inner Harbor at this point, but fairly far up, certainly to the bridge. So how are they here? What age classes are here? What are they doing here? So we're looking forward to beginning some of that work.
Have you ever been in a position where you had to help a local animal that was in distress?
Yeah, so we do have an animal rescue group, and that's the other arm that I work with. And so we work with the Department of Natural Resources when you're doing
in Maryland,
when you're doing rescue work like that, when you're working with endangered species and sea turtles and marine mammals, the permission to do that all comes from the federal government through NOAA. Mm-hmm. for the marine mammals. And we're actually part of an amazing stranding network of facilities all up and down the coast. And our regional one is sort of from Virginia up through Maine. And so we work with sea turtles here. We work with sea turtles that may come in from our partner organization. So if they're full and we have space, we'll help them out and take animals and vice versa. And we also do a lot of work with pinnipeds that way as well.
Pinnipeds.
Seals. So we have a growing, the seal population as it's recovering is moving further and further south. And so we actually have a fair amount of harbor seals and gray seals off the Atlantic coastline. And those guys are starting to live here year round. They used to just be seasonal visitors, and now they're overwintering here, and we've got a number of young of the year that sometimes get in trouble, and we try to give them a little bit of a helping hand.
And you said you work with terns as well, seabirds?
No, sea turtles.
Okay.
Yeah, sorry, just we that. Haven't done the bird. We sorry. Don't do the birds at this point.
Okay, so I misunderstood earlier, sorry. You wanted to throw something in.
Yeah, is there an especially memorable rescue case that you've been a part of?
Yeah, I think one of the more interesting ones was a sea turtle that came in with a very old wound on one of its flippers. It had fishing line wrapped mm-hmm. around the upper limb, and we made the decision that we couldn't spare the limb. And so we amputated the limb, and the turtle recovered very well. And in talking with the federal government, typically they would not have historically allowed an animal with just three flippers to be released. Mm-hmm. But they'd been noting more and more that there were three-limbed sea turtles that did seem to be surviving and, from shark bites, natural problems out in the wild. And so we worked with them to make a determination to go ahead and try to release this animal. And we put a satellite tag on her that was good for about 30 days, maybe a little bit longer, and documented that she was sort of seemed to be following the normal sea turtle path and seemed to be doing well, at least for that time period. So that was a neat one because we were able to help her, but also able to work with the federal government to try something new. In general, our goal with these animals that come in is to turn them around as long as we think they're going to have a good quality of life.
Has working here shaped your sense of Baltimore at all?
Yeah, I definitely think it has. I'm from Massachusetts, so I hadn't spent much time here. And I think being at the aquarium, you see the students come in and you see people come in and you just sort of see how excited they get and how you can get them to understand a little bit more about the natural world that they live in, just even right here in Maryland. And one of my favorite areas is our native habitat. And, you know, we've got a stream exhibit that is mimicking a little stream that you might see out in the mountains. And we've got a marsh exhibit. And you sort of get this progression of where water goes from up in the mountains out to the ocean. And it's really, I do sometimes just like to sit there and kind of point out the bullfrog and the terrapin and the little turtles and see people get really excited about that and begin to get them to understand that this can be in their backyard if we start making, you know, they're challenging efforts, but begin to make those efforts to try to create a world where people and the non-human animals can all live together. And how do we do this? Same with out here in the harbor. We've got actually a lot of animals out there. There's a lot of fish that live in there. And it's fun to point those out. You'll be walking along and you can look down there. There's fish. And they're, what? Oh, my God. People have no idea that this isn't. They think it's just dead. And it's not. It's alive.
Do you have any tips for home aquarium keepers to keep their fish alive?
Take care of the water. If you take care of the water well and the water is healthy, your fish will often thrive. So you have to think like a step removed from the animal. You're thinking about its environment.
What's the best way to make sure the water is appropriately...
Do get your little water chemistry testing kit from the pet shop or online and make sure that particularly your ammonia and your pH are trending where they should. Understand the needs of the fish that you're putting into your community tank. talk with, you know, if you can get experts at the pet store or online now, there's some good fish forums. Uh-huh. And I would highly recommend planning it out ahead of time. When you're working with animals, you don't want to necessarily wing it.
Yeah.
Winging it often doesn't work out well for the animals.
Do you keep fish yourself at home?
I don't actually. I just have dogs. People ask me what the easiest animals are, and I think, kind of dogs. Maybe cats.
Thank you so much for taking the time
You're
to
welcome.
Talk to us.
Well, thank you for coming in and seeing the aquarium as part of your Baltimore
I'm
visit.
So delighted that we were able to. I learned so much. Thank you.
Good. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Working. I'm Jacob Brogan. We'd love to hear your thoughts about the podcast. Our email address is working@slate.com. You can also listen to past episodes at slate.com/working. Working is produced and edited by Mickey Kapper. Our executive producer is Steve Lichtai. June Thomas is the managing producer of Slate Podcasts. And the chief content officer of the Panoply Network is Andy Bowers.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
On Death, Sex, and Money, we feature interviews with you, our community of listeners, getting honest about uncomfortable things.
I developed an illness where it isn't safe for me to drive. A friend once said to me, "Sex is like air. You don't think about it until you're not getting enough." This is a similar sort of thing if you just replace sex with driving.
Listen to Death, Sex, and Money wherever you get podcasts.